visor and helmet combination that looked like a bug's carapace. He shouted and pointed at the jet's fuselage. "The gun! The gun!" Miller scrambled up the ladder to the cockpit and leaned in close enough to Worm that he could smell the sharp stink of sweat mixed with jet fuel. "Maybe 100 rounds before it jams," he shouted. Shit. At the machine cannon's rate of fire, that was possibly 3 seconds worth of shooting. Worm gave a quick look at the plane's cockpit screens to make sure the aircraft was running the pre-flight checks. At least something was working as it should. For a second, maybe two, Worm allowed himself to think of his fiancée. She'd be out surfing about now, working off some of the dark energy her dreams often left her with. They were supposed to meet at the Moana Surfrider Hotel that night for a drink. She hadn't told him which of the bars she'd be in, though she never did. He would have to find her, and then they would sip Mai Tais and fantasize about what it would be like to get married there. He had promised her a fairy tale ending to her story. The image was dashed as the canopy closed down. Worm flashed a thumbs up to the crew chief below and mouthed a word. Payback. USS Coronado, Joint Base Pearl Harbor, Hickam, Hawaii. An anti-tank rocket fired from a nearby freighter hit the USS Gabrielle Giffords, moored nearby. It was unnecessary. The Giffords was already taking on water from an explosion below the waterline, as were most of the U.S. Navy warships in the harbor. "Is Athena online yet?" shouted Captain Riley. The automated threat-enhanced network awareness program was like the ship's nervous system, tying together sensors and network nodes with software that was as close to artificial intelligence as the Navy would permit aboard a warship. The ship's autonomous battle management system allowed a short-handed ship like the Coronado to track targets and coordinate with other forces faster than a human crew could manage. "Almost ready," said one of the crew. "It's still booting up." "Wake the bitch up! I want targets, and I want the ship protected," said Captain Riley. "Sir, even when it's online, Athena's going to have trouble in port," said Simmons. "We're already in trouble," said Captain Riley. "The data flow might overwhelm it. If Athena crashes, it'll drag down the rest of the ship's systems. Or we might get some blue-on-blue, given the range we're dealing with," said Simmons. "Let the crew fight the ship. Trust them." Captain Riley squinted the way he did when he knew someone else was right. "Good call, XO," he said. "When Athena comes up, keep it in watch mode." This gave Captain Riley, still in his skivvies, the chance to deliver the order he'd yearned to give all his life. "Main gun, batteries release! Engage enemy ship! The fucker that fired at us!" he shouted. The Coronado's 57mm main gun came to life. The turret pivoted, pointed an accusing finger off the port side, and then fired across the harbor at the Directorate freighter, from which the rocket smoke trail still extended. After 7 rounds, the main gun's firing paused, and then the realization sank in among the bridge crew. The tiny cannon's 5-pound shells were far too small to do any real damage to a 100,000-ton freighter twice the size of a World War II battleship. The LCS had a main gun fit for chasing away pirates, but not much more. Tracer rounds began to flash toward the Coronado, yellow lines reaching out from the freighter and two other ships in the harbor. Their fire hadn't had much of an effect, but it had gotten the other side's attention. Heavy machine gun rounds clanged into the Coronado's superstructure. A sailor struggling to untie the ship's forward lines from the pier's cleats disappeared in a puff of red. Simmons peeked his binoculars through the open bridge hatch and panned them quickly around the harbor. He frowned. He could see small boats being launched from the freighters. They were at least 9 Navy ships sinking, and 4 others being swarmed by what looked like boarding teams. A fast-moving black dart, a helicopter of some sort, sent a volley of rockets into the bridge of the USS Pinckney. In the distance, green-tracked vehicles moved down the road closest to the shoreline. He suspected they were not friendly. He put the binoculars down when he heard Captain Riley shout into his headset, "Just someone cut the damn mooring lines!" The Coronado's foredeck was empty. Bloodstains on the deck marked where 2 more sailors who tried to free the ship had been cut down. Simmons winced, knowing that they would need every sailor they had to get the ship out of this kill zone. Nearing the Coronado's bow, Horowitz looked up at the bridge. He'd run out of 5.56mm rounds for his M4 and had been ferrying ammunition to a sailor firing an M249 machine gun at the nearby freighter. "On it!" Horowitz shouted. He raced inside the nearby passageway and pulled out the fire axe. He ran toward the rope, but slipped on a pool of blood and cut his palm on the blade of the axe. He couldn't help himself and laughed. The absurdity of slicing yourself with an axe in the middle of a gunfight. Horowitz belly crawled out to the mooring line, staying low to avoid the fire. When he reached it, he jumped up, held the axe high over his head, and then smashed it down on the thick braided Kevlar line tying the Coronado to the pier. It made little impression. The axe parted only a few strands. He lifted it again and again. Soon, his chest heaved and his arms burned, and he couldn't hear anything but the buzzing in his ears. At some point, a bullet struck the red axe head, but Horowitz held it fast despite the ache in his hands. One of the ship's caterpillar-like safers, shipboard autonomous firefighting robots, crawled onto the deck nearby and was immediately hit. The child-sized robot sprayed a cloud of chemical retardant all over the deck before rolling into the water. "One last time," Horowitz said to himself with a grunt, "and then we are out of here." He didn't see the Directorate PGZ-07 anti-aircraft vehicle that rounded the corner on the rise above the pier. Without any targets in the sky, the PGZ trained its twin-barreled 35mm cannon on the U.S. ships in the harbor, the closest being the Coronado. "Shit," said Simmons as he watched Horowitz's shredded body cartwheel into the water. "Target, starboard side! Hit that bastard! He's the one who just lit us up!" shouted Captain Riley. The ship's 57mm MK-110 cannon rotated away from the freighter and toward the directorate vehicle as fast as the gunner could pull the targeting joystick. While the main gun couldn't make much of an impact on a 100,000-ton ship, the rounds chewed apart the lightly armored 22-ton vehicle, and it exploded, sending flaming shrapnel through the building behind it. Simmons was in command mode, listening to his crew on his headset as much as directing them. He heard shouting one moment, then dispassionate descriptions of overheating or damaged equipment. The crew was proving to be good under pressure, which was exactly why he had driven them so hard. "We've got to go now, Captain. Line's all but cut through," said Simmons. "You heard him. Get us out of here," said Captain Riley. Simmons recognized the false confidence in the captain's voice. They both knew the Coronado would have to battle its way out of the flaming harbor. A sudden buzzing noise made everyone on the bridge duck. A quadcopter appeared right in front of the bridge's windows, nervously hovering, like a wasp, looking for a way inside. The MK-110 main gun spun to engage the V-1000, but the quadcopter hovered inside the gun's arc of fire, feinting and dodging with the turret's jerky moves, as the gunner tried to slew the joystick fast enough to get a shot at it. The bridge crew froze, expecting a volley of armor-piercing flechette micro-rockets. The V-1000 flared back, flashing a backlit view of its empty rocket pods, and then raced straight up and out of sight. The crew members looked at one another as if they just missed being hit by lightning. Then the quadcopter reappeared a football field's length away and dove between a pair of long warehouses. It popped back up into the air and vectored toward the KITV Channel 4 news chopper that had arrived to collect video of what had been reported as a gas explosion down at the harbor. The V-1000 fired a TY-90 air-to-air missile that struck the helicopter well before the weapon reached its Mach 2 maximum speed. The drop-down bow thruster pushed the Coronado slowly away from the pier, and then Stapleton, the main propulsion assistant, gently moved the joystick forward. The Coronado roared, its engines moving from idle into action, and the water jets roiled the harbor water. The last Kevlar mooring line started to unravel, and then parted with a snap. As the ship began to gather speed, another anti-tank missile arced from the freighter and exploded inside the helicopter hangar. It felt to the crew like someone had driven a garbage truck into the side of the superstructure, but the ship kept moving. Simmons looked over at the communication station as heavy machine cannon fire ripped through the ship's aluminum hull and shattered the sailor sitting there. Sparks and blood mingled together in an instant. More gunfire peppered the bridge, blowing out windows that were strong enough to handle the angry ocean, but no match for armor-piercing rounds. He fell to the deck and covered his head as shrapnel fell around him. When Simmons opened his eyes, he saw Captain Riley next to him on the floor, but sitting upright, his back against the mauled captain's chair. Blood soaked his shirt and pooled on the deck around him. Another burst of fire slapped into the captain's chair. Frantically, Simmons looked around to see who was driving the ship. Nobody. Stapleton lay in a heap next to his chair, and the ship slowly drifted toward the opposite side of the harbor. Only one of the 3D battle displays was working. The Athena system projected fragmented visuals of the chaos across the room.
"Helm! Somebody drive the goddamn ship!" shouted Simmons.
Jefferson ran to the helm and pushed the joystick forward. In one of the many exercises the sailors hated, Simmons had made sure that everyone on the bridge crew was trained to take over the other stations, just in case. Riley tried to force himself up by his elbows but slid back. Simmons knelt by him and ripped open the captain's shirt. But after that, he didn't know where to start or what to do. Riley's entire chest was a bloody mess, his heart pumping more of his life onto the gray deck with each beat. Riley coughed up blood.
"Get back to conning your ship, Captain Simmons," Riley said with a slight smile.
Dylan Coate, the ship's corpsman, entered the bridge at a run but slipped on the blood underfoot. On his hands and knees, he crawled to the captain and pushed Simmons aside. As Coate tried to staunch the blood flow, Simmons carefully rose and stood behind Jefferson at the helm. The captain's chair had jagged holes punched in it, and he wasn't ready to sit in it just yet. Marine Corps Base, Kaneoha Bay, Hawaii. Worm banked the F-35B hard to the left immediately after takeoff. The jet shifted smoothly into forward flight mode, and he tried to gain some kind of situational awareness, just like they taught him in flight school. The AN-AAQ-37, Electro-Optical Distributed Aperture System, fed his helmet with data from visual and IR sensors located around the plane, allowing him to see through the plane below. And what he saw was chaos. He'd once flown through a forest fire during a training mission in California's Sierra Nevada mountains. This was worse. All the smoke and debris in the air had created a swirl of darkness with patches of bright sun. Chinese drones darted in and out of the smoke at low levels, and on the deck, along with fragments of Marine Corps helicopters, his squadron's fighters lay scattered about like puzzle pieces. He scanned up and around the sky and confirmed what he'd feared. His was the only U.S. jet in the air. He started to check on the jet's other systems. No sound came over his radios. The fighter's GPS-coupled inertial navigation system was wrong, showing him as flying over Maui, when he knew damn well this was Oahu. Electronically generated false targets flickered on the horizontal situation display and then disappeared. The plane, with its novel software systems and millions of lines of code, was designed to be its own co-pilot, capable of automation and interpretation never before possible in battle. But at this moment, Worm thought, the fighter was having trouble getting out of its own way, electronically speaking. Marine aviators had flown for generations with just guns and guts, Worm told himself. He could do the same. At the near corner of the airfield, he saw one of the tiny Chinese quadcopters firing its autocannon, peppering a dark Osprey tilt-rotor aircraft. First, the starboard wing buckled, and then the MV-22's massive engine dropped to the ground, tipping over the ungainly aircraft. With one hand, Worm slowed the jet's approach, and with the other, he targeted the quadcopter on the touchscreens before him. Then he saw her. The Defiance was unmistakable even at this distance. He magnified the image through his helmet optics, effectively creating a picture inside a picture on the screen superimposed in his cockpit. The Marine fired her pistol at the drone that had rocketed the Osprey. She stood with her feet braced and leaned over the still-smoking engine to steady her aim. She fired a full magazine, then ducked down to reload. As she drew the magazine from a pouch on her flight suit, the quadcopter dropped to within a few inches of the ground and circled back around her position. She spun around too. Worm saw her chambering the next round as she raised her weapon. He wheeled his jet's cannon arming protocol to speed up. She fired, and then darted to the other side of the wreckage, racing to keep it between her and the quadcopter, like a lethal game of musical chairs. Then she slipped in a pool of oil seeping out of the gutted Osprey, twisted her left leg, and fell down in a heap. The pistol skittered a few feet away.
Shit!
Shouted Worm. The gun pod light turned red, active. The jet shifted position slightly as Worm tried to line up the F-35's cannon. But then, the quadcopter drone rose abruptly. It had caught onto the game and was moving to gain an overhead shot on the fallen Marine. Worm nudged the jet up, using its thrust vectoring nozzles, in effect, dancing in the air. As he maneuvered to line up his gun pod, his helmet display showed the Marine crawling toward her pistol. It was lodged beneath a smoldering wing from a nearby wrecked F-35. Jesus, what ball she had, thought Worm. His finger was already over the trigger, and he pressed down lightly. The jet buffeted as the rounds fired off. The drone opened fire at the same time as Worm's jet loosed a line of training rounds that walked their way up the runway to the quadcopter. The image on the helmet display dissolved into an explosion of smoke and flame, and the drone spun down into the burning Osprey wreck. Where was she? His headset suddenly growled at him, and a flash of color danced across one of his displays. The warning from the jet's radar threat detection system was unmistakable. An air defense system was tracking him. The readout showed that the radar that had washed over his jet wasn't a U.S. system, but an H-250 phased array, the updated Directorate Mobile SAM type. Oh, shit, said Worm. That can't be. It wasn't the threat of being shot down that chilled him, despite the sweat in his flight suit. What this meant was much worse than that. They somehow already had major forces on the ground. The Directorate armored column from the Golden Wave and Hilde Manor had bulldozed through the parked cars in the lot and left Pier 29 behind. After that, the column had split, and the two lines headed off in different directions. One column of Type 99 tanks and their supporting vehicles raced off to link up with Directorate airborne troops, disembarking from a trio of Harmony Airways Airbus A380s that had just landed at Honolulu International Airport. The other armored column went down the North Nimitz Highway out of town. Worm knew where they were heading. For all the historic value of taking Pearl Harbor, Camp H.M. Smith was the real prize. The headquarters of Pacific Command was designed to house the military's peacetime bureaucracy, not fight off an invasion force. The Marines there would fight to the last round, Worm was certain, but there was no way they could stop a column of tanks. And then, the command and control hub of the entire Pacific would be in what? Was the right term enemy hands? It was incomprehensible. Worm rechecked his weapon state, 71 rounds. He took the plane back down for the deck and raced low across the runway. As he passed, he saw the Osprey's wreckage, and then he saw a figure pop out from behind it, and she waved. What a warrior. That Marine needs to get the hell out of there, said Worm, finding himself in conversation with his jet again, as happened when he needed to lock down his fear. The jet's horizontal situation display revealed a Chinese-made Z-10 attack helicopter moving in toward the runway. It wouldn't take long for the Z-10 to discover the woman's position, and she was clearly fool enough to start taking pot shots at it. A fellow Marine needed him, and he'd been taught since training that you never, ever left a Marine behind. But there was the force headed for Camp Smith. He didn't have enough rounds left to take the tanks out completely, but a few low passes might stall them. Maybe he could hit a command vehicle or disable the lead tank. He eased the jet skyward and gained another 500 feet, seeking an answer. And more knots for the next strafing run. His options were clear. His choice was not. U.S. Navy P-8, Pacific Ocean. Too much jamming.
Turn off the feed, said Commander Bill Sweetie Darling. Let's focus on Foxglove 2, not the whole war. Darling couldn't believe he just said war so casually. That's what it was. America was at war in the Pacific, and he assumed elsewhere in the world. And a few minutes into the war, he could already tell that a major problem would be filtering out useful data from the flow that gushed over them, as if from a fire hose.
Understood, said Hammer, the naval flight officer who handled the plane's communications. I'll bring it back up if the jamming stops.
90 miles from the formation of U.S. ships, Darling's P-8 was on the hunt. A Type 93A submarine that had been tagged Foxglove 2 lurked somewhere nearby. The attack on Pearl Harbor was underway, but for Darling and his crew, the task was the same as it always was on patrol: find and prosecute. This particular submarine had been tailing the USS George H.W. Bush for a couple of days. Yesterday, it was just a nuisance that had added some edge to their flight ops. Today, it was an immediate threat that they had to shut down in the next few minutes or face a lifetime of knowing they had failed to protect a big deck carrier with over 4,000 sailors on board. Fortunately, Darling's crew had help hunting the Directorate submarine. The USS John Warner, a Virginia-class nuclear attack submarine, was herding the submarine away from the carrier strike group into the P-8's picket line of sonobuoys. Pinned in, Foxglove 2 would die. The main battle network communications feed blared into their headsets, garbled from the jamming.
Damn it, Hammer, turn that, said Darling.
Another voice cut him off.
Hydrophone effects. Sonobuoys just located Foxglove 2, said Hyde, one of the two crew members who handled the acoustic sensor systems. It's heading on a course away from the strike group, 12 knots.
Darling nosed the P-8 over hard to get closer to the sea, pushing the throttles forward and banking the jet toward the intercept point projected on the screen in front of him. The plane's speed edged up to almost 500 knots as the crew counted down the seconds until they could fire on the submarine.
At 500 feet, releasing Mark 54, said his co-pilot, Fang Treehorn.
Incoming, incoming! Stonefish inbound on the bush, interrupted Jekyll, the plane's other sensor operator. Goddamn NSA hackers were supposed to be able to keep those things from even getting off the ground.
Near the horizon, faint white stalks grew skyward from the area around the bush. The fleet's defense systems began firing dozens of RIM 161 SM-3 missiles, designed to intercept incoming Stonefish ballistic missiles as they entered the atmosphere.
Bush's Athena shows it is 26 inbound. Our SAMs are countering, Jekyll reported, giving a play-by-play of the air battle.
Mark 54 away, said Fang.
The plane lifted slightly as the Mark 54 was released, and the torpedo splashed into the water below, its propeller already rotating toward the submarine. The air defense communications feed, coming through the headphones, suddenly became intelligible, then quickly reverted back to garbled noise. Fang had a pair of binoculars up, trying to track the dozens of air defense missiles that raced up into the sky to meet the warheads, arcing down toward the carrier and its escort ships.
Where'd they come from? Said Fang.
China, said Darling.
Yeah, asshole, I know, said Fang. Surprise attacks don't have just one surprise. Think they're nukes?
Nope. If it was a nuke, they'd only send one, said Darling.
Stonefish inbound in 15 seconds,
said Jekyll, her jaw an attempt to hide the stress she was feeling.
Mark 54 impact, Foxglove 2 destroyed, said Hyde.
10 seconds, said Jekyll.
Keep working the sonobuoys, Hyde, said Darling.
He felt no satisfaction from taking out the sub. The Type 93 hadn't been the main threat after all. He felt worse than unsatisfied. He felt useless. His plane and crew were of no help at this moment.
Wait, I got one.
Damn, it's pretty close to us, said Fang, watching through his binoculars. And here it goes, splashdown.
Shit. 90 miles off target. That's quite a miss, said Darling.
Maybe the Stonefish isn't the boogeyman after all.
Fang kept staring through his binoculars. Fang. A flash on the horizon gave Darling his answer.
Impact, 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 said Jekyll.
Darling thanked God that they were so far away from the blast, and then a wave of guilt washed over him.
Get John Warner on the net, said Darling, and see how they want to help with recovery. We need to set up a Sonobuoy perimeter around the task force.
Update from the Stockdale's Athena, Jekyll said, naming one of the escort ships. Confirms what we saw. At least 3 stonefish hit the bush. The ship's, offline now.
Can't raise the John Warner, said Hammer. GPS is offline again.
Same up front. Checking Warner's last location, said Darling.
He tried not to look at Fang, who was fiddling with his helmet and surreptitiously wiping tears away.
The P-8 was banked in a turn when Darling saw something in the water below. He squinted, willing the jet lower so he could see. Fang brought his binoculars back up even as the display screens showed the debris in detail.
That's too far from the task force to be from the bush or any of the escort ships, said Darling.
What is that? Our directorate sub?
No. Foxglove 2's last position is on the grid way over there, said Fang, jabbing a finger at the cockpit screen.
Shit, said Jekyll, nervously tapping her hand on her knee.
This is the impact point for that stonefish we saw. It didn't miss. That's what's left of the John Warner.
Marine Corps Base, Kaneoha Bay, Hawaii. The F-35 rotated its nose up and then looped over in a corkscrew twist, giving Worm one last view of the sky through the bottom of his plane. 71 rounds. Worm designated the target, feeling the jet adjust slightly. As he arced back down toward the Osprey's wreckage, he saw the defiant Marine pop up and begin running. Just 71 rounds. Worm found the Z-10 strafing a smoking hangar 100 yards away from her. One of the quadcopters saw her and raced toward her position, then hovered to beckon the helicopter over. Worm dipped the nose of the jet and eased the throttle forward. With a gentle adjustment, he rolled out and centered the helmet-mounted Pipper on the Z-10. He relaxed his G slightly to stay on the target and then squeezed the trigger. The opening burst from the F-35's cannon went high, passed over the Z-10, and ripped apart the runway just beyond. 47 rounds. She ran faster, not looking back, even at the ripping sound in the sky behind her. Worm fired a longer burst, and the whole jet vibrated like a tuning fork. The Z-10 jerked sideways, then broke in half, spewing flame and debris in a near-perfect circle. The fuselage groaned in protest as Worm pulled back on the stick to arrest his descent. The runner was nowhere to be seen. She had made it. He'd done his first duty. He hadn't left a Marine behind. Worm jammed the throttle forward to its stops and unloaded to accelerate toward Camp H.M. Smith as fast as possible. Having some American air power overhead might give the armored directorate column second thoughts, maybe even force it to divert to another target. He had nothing else to offer. The cannon was empty. Landing to rearm was out of the question. He'd harass the directorate column as long as he could, and then punch out somewhere up north, near one of the parks. As the F-35 accelerated away, the robotic quadcopter turned and loosed an air-to-air missile. It then blithely went back to its original task of raking the row of Ospreys on the runway. Even before Worm heard the alarm buzz, the plane's AN-ASQ-239 Barracuda system had automatically activated. The system's 10 tiny antennas embedded in the F-35's wing edges began to track the enemy missile's radar. Worm's visor projected that it was a TY-90, a fire-and-forget missile. So even with its robot master focused elsewhere, it was still a threat. With the missile homing in on him, he pulled the F-35 hard right toward the Ulupau crater at the end of the base. With just a little bit of luck, he thought, he'd disappear in the clutter around the old dormant volcano. He'd be damned if he was going to be the first Marine pilot to get shot down by a drone. Worm's fate, though, had been decided several months earlier. A section of microchips had been replaced during maintenance. This was nothing unusual for a plane packed with thousands of chips that ran everything from avionics to the gun camera. The first microchips that had powered everything from the early computers to the jet planes of the 1960s had all their components visible to the naked eye.
By the turn of the 21st century, however, microchips packed millions of transistors into an area measured in square millimeters. And every chip was further divided into multiple subunits called blocks, each of which carried out different functions. Much like the chips inside a smartphone, the processor in Worm's F-35 gun camera, for example, had blocks that did everything from store frames of video to convert files. When the microchip industry took off, it grew from just a handful of companies to more than 2,000, most of them in China, each creating 5,000 new chip designs every year. These designs involved thousands of people at multiple locations, each team working on a different block, sometimes building it from scratch, sometimes contracting it out, and other times buying it from a third-party specialist. And each of those block designs was integrated into millions of chips, and those chips went into everything from toasters to Tomahawk missiles. The result was a dangerous combination. The chips became so complex that no single engineer or team of engineers could understand how all their parts actually worked. The design process was so distributed that no one could vet all the people involved. And the chips were manufactured and bought in such great numbers that not even a tiny percentage could be tested, which almost no buyers, including the big American defense firms, even tried to do. Efficiency always beat security. For a long time, defense analysts had worried about the notion of a kill switch, a chip that would shut down an entire computer system on command. But on Worm's plane, the opposite happened. In each of just 12 microchips, a tiny piece of technology inside a single block woke up. The F-35B was protected by its shape and stealth materials that shrank its radar signature to a size smaller than a metal fist. But as the Directorate missile's radar washed over the plane, it activated a tiny antenna hidden in the ninth block of each of 12 microchips that linked Worm's helmet display system to the plane's flight control system. Even if the helmet's manufacturers had performed a security scan when they'd bought the microchips, they still would have missed it. Each antenna was microscopic, hidden inside a 1 millimeter square, and activated only by a specific frequency of an incoming missile. While each antenna had just a tiny amount of energy on its own, the combination of them sent enough power to broadcast what was, in effect, a homing signal. As Worm accelerated away, the missile picked up the signal and pursued the fighter. Worm dove toward the palms of the Ulupau crater in a bid to mask his plane from the missile's radar. He grunted as the G-forces pushed him down into his seat. Then, he jinked hard. He should have been able to shake it, but whatever he did made no difference today. The missile followed his every move. In his last moments, Worm glanced down at the watch his fiancée had given him for his 31st birthday, a Breitling Aggressor digital chronograph. It was as much to think of her one last time as it was to, like a physician, mark the time of death. The missile rode the giveaway signal like a rail and slammed into the side of the F-35, splitting the jet into two pieces that tumbled into the Pacific. USS Coronado, Joint Base Pearl Harbor, Hickam, Hawaii. Simmons knew the outcome of the next few moments would be a binary choice. Win or lose, live or die. As the Coronado pushed back from the pier, fresh air began flowing through blown-out windows and holes shot through the aluminum superstructure. Only Directorate helicopters and drones circled in the sky. One of the helicopters had just dive-bombed into the open side of the hangar deck of the USS Boxer, the amphibious assault ship used by the 15th Marine Expeditionary Unit, burst into flames, setting fire to the ship moored behind it, some kind of transport Simmons couldn't identify. A chainsaw-like noise and then a line of yellow tracers arcing out from the ship snapped Simmons back into focus. The Coronado's MK-110 gun engaged one of the smaller surveillance drones that swooped inside its line of fire. Simmons couldn't see any other U.S. ships moving from their moorings. That made the Coronado an even more conspicuous target.
"All ahead full! Take it to 25 knots," said Simmons. "When we pass the Arizona Memorial, make it 40. And then, once we're clear in the channel, flank speed, no matter what, fast as the ship can make." "Aye, Captain," said Jefferson without hesitation. Good man, normally running a 418-foot ship
At that reckless speed inside a harbor was a quick way to a brutal collision or grounding, not to mention a court-martial. But now all that mattered was escaping the harbor's kill box. The Coronado jerked forward, and it felt for a moment as if the trimaran's hull was moving at a different speed than the superstructure above. Simmons hoped the ship wouldn't come apart. Between the rocket hits and the earlier impact of the Remus, there was no telling how much damage had been done. The squat effect of the engine's powering lifted the bow higher than the stern, like a kid doing a wheelie on a bike. But the ship evened out as it accelerated onto a plane past the smoldering hulks of the Pacific Fleet, and then the old Arizona and Missouri memorials. The first ship had already been sunk, while the second didn't seem to have a scratch on it. The Coronado had a clear shot at one of the Directorate freighters, but Simmons didn't bother. The LCS was fast, but another wrinkle of her design was that the main gun wobbled so badly at high speeds that it wasn't even worth the shot. The Coronado was accelerating around the turn in the bay when the burning USS Lake Erie, a Ticonderoga-class Aegis cruiser, detonated its entire magazine. The shockwave pitched the Coronado, almost swamping the ship before the ride control system automatically righted it. The water jets were picking up speed, though, and the ship exited the harbor at 48 knots, racing away as a final Directorate rocket-propelled grenade landed 100 feet short.
"Athena, damage! Crew status!"
Simmons barked into his command headset.
"Sisfig ship, tor wheat loss," the computer replied. "Part route, tactical, meant offline ties."
"What the hell? Cortez, damage and crew status," Simmons said,
cupping his hands around his mouth against the wind rushing through the bridge. Lieutenant Horatio Cortez, the tactical action officer who was now the XO by default, looked over and nodded. Then the formal Naval Academy water polo player seemed to stare right through his superior officer. It wasn't fear or disrespect. He was focusing on the projections inside his Oakley tactical viz glasses. A bloody thumbprint smeared the left lens, but from the inside, he could see visuals of the ship's data stream.
"Athena's still monitoring the ship, but something in its comms hardware has been damaged. Superstructure, well, you can see that, sir. One of the diesels is leaking coolant. So we're going to need to bring our speed down soon. Bow section has a foot of water, but it's under control. Main gun down to 15 rounds, and fire control is iffy. Communications are still out," said Cortez.
"Casualties,"
said Simmons, looking at the captain's chair. The Coronado was already under-crewed by design, for the sake of efficiency, went the thinking. In peacetime, losing anyone out of the tight duty rotation was a headache. During war, it could be deadly to the ship and the entire crew.
"Athena shows 12 KIA, said Cortez. 11 wounded.
"God damn it," muttered Simmons.
Then realizing he'd left the headset microphone on transmit, he fumbled to shut it off.
"Where to now, sir?"
asked Jefferson. Simmons could see a dark, wet spot on the top of Jefferson's head, but he wasn't sure if it was Jefferson's blood or someone else's.
"Sir?"
someone else quietly asked.
What now?
His father had said this was what command was like, a constant stream of questions. He wheeled sharply. It was the corpsman, Coat. Shit. How had he forgotten about the captain? Then he saw Coat's face and realized it didn't matter anymore.
"A moment, sir," said Coat. "Take off your shirt."
Simmons looked at Coat with a mix of anger and incomprehension.
"Not now," said Simmons.
"Sir, let me do my job," said Coat.
Simmons quickly pulled off his uniform top and felt a sharp sting behind his right shoulder blade, some kind of cut he hadn't even realized was there. Coat removed a small silver aerosol bottle from a waist pack and sprayed it on the wound. In an instant, the pain was gone, and Simmons could feel his shoulder relax.
"Okay, Cortez, when Coat is done, help him get Captain Riley's body below. He doesn't deserve this," said Simmons. "Jefferson, let's dip the towed array sonar to see what's out there. I'll try to link with the Packham to find out what the hell they want us to do. Keep everyone at stations."
While Simmons was tucking his shirt in, Coat studied his new captain. Without a word,
The corpsman detached a hard plastic case from his belt and examined the dozens of color-coded pills inside, reverently holding the case as if it were a small Bible.
"Here, sir," said Coat. "There's a..."
"Just give them to me," Simmons said, and he downed 3 tabs. He knew what they were by the colors. A green modafinil, for endurance and focus, an orange beta blocker to steady his nerves, and a yellow desmopressin to boost his memory and keep him from having to leave the bridge to pee. Coat and Cortez were carrying the body toward the hatch when an alarm from the tactical display made them both stop. They left Riley's body at the sill of the hatch and raced back to their stations.
"Ah, shit! Hydrophone effects," said Jefferson, as the sonar reading started to come in.
"Torpedo in the water, sir. Bearing 045. It's close, 3,000 yards.
At that moment, Simmons realized that his first ship command would not be a long one. Of course, the directorate would leave nothing to chance. Some Type 93 sub was probably lurking at the entrance to sink any survivors who managed to make it out of Pearl Harbor. All he'd accomplished was to take the Coronado from one trap right into another. Simmons tried to stay calm.
"Bring us back up to flank speed. If they want to get us, they're going to have to race for it."
Part 3. All warfare is based on deception. Sun Tzu, The Art of War. Duke's Bar, Waikiki Beach, Hawaii Special Administrative Zone. She was a goddess. Xiao Zheng knew he would never have had a chance with a girl like this back home in Wuhan. When he was in elementary school, he'd thought being surrounded by so many boys and so few girls was a good thing. But at 18, Xiao realized that all it meant was that even the ugliest ducklings had their pick of the boys. And he was not the kind of boy they picked. He wore thick black bamboo-framed glasses because he was the only one in his unit whose eyes hadn't responded well to the mandatory vision enhancement surgery. The goddess wore a flowing blue skirt and a tight white tank top. She had a leather backpack-style purse slung across her shoulder. As she entered Duke's, she adjusted her white-framed sunglasses on the bridge of her nose and let down her ebony hair. Xiao had to tell himself to start breathing again. He'd been deployed to Honolulu for 3 months now, and he still had trouble working up the courage to speak to the female Marines in his unit. As she crossed the room, a group of sailors shouted at her in broken English to come drink with them. She ignored them, and Xiao's heart soared. The vision made her way through the crowded bar, smiling at the other girls scattered among the tables drinking vodka shots or white wine with the various directorate soldiers. These were prostitutes, most of them flown in from back home. But this one was clearly something different. Xiao Zheng knew he was staring, but the young directorate Marine couldn't help himself. She stopped at the bar and pushed her sunglasses up on the top of her head. The way she held herself made it clear she could not be bought. She had to be earned. For the next hour, he watched her. With someone so beautiful, sometimes watching was enough.
"Another round!" shouted Bo Dai from the bar stool next to Xiao Sheng, elbowing Xiao in the ribs.
A microphone on Bo's digital dog tags around his neck transmitted the command to a small translator he wore on his belt. The card deck-sized device scratchily conveyed his bellowed command in tinny English a moment earlier. Bo was the senior enlisted Marine in Xiao's squad, and he usually looked out for him. 9 brimming shot glasses arrived quickly, as if the bartender had anticipated the order.
"Drink, you pussy!"
Bo shouted at the top of his lungs before putting Xiao in a gentle headlock. The translator device started to convey the bawdy order before Bo silenced it with a drunken slap. Xiao cringed and downed the shot. It was warm tequila, and he gagged as Bo whooped.
"Okay, no more of this mooning over some local whore. I need to know my best assistant machine gunner is not afraid of girls. Because if he is, then what's he going to do when the Americans from California come for us with both barrels?"
Bo mimed an enormous pair of breasts. The big sergeant dragged Xiao over to the goddess and set him down on the bar stool next to her like an offering.
Xiao stood back up. His knees trembled. He had to get out of there. Go anywhere but where he really wanted to be. Xiao's legs were unsteady. He turned to go, but knocked over the stool. A lithe and deeply tanned arm reached out to catch him by the shoulder before he fell too. Easy there, sailor, she said. She touched me, Xiao wanted to shout. What to say? What was the Hawaiian phrase for hello, they had learned? Olaha? No. He wanted her to hear his own words, even if he didn't know what they should be. But before he could say anything to the goddess, her sunglasses fell to the floor, and she slipped off her stool and bent down to pick them up, giving Xiao an unforgettable view. I need to go wash these off. Then you can buy me a drink? She asked. Xiao nodded silently, and she smiled before disappearing into the back of the crowded bar. He fished in his pocket for some bills to pay the bartender for another wine for her, so it would be waiting when she returned. Shit! He cursed out loud. He stumbled and rushed back to the table where he had been sitting earlier. His wallet had to be there. His squad mates registered the intense look on Xiao's face as he dropped to all fours in front of everyone in the restaurant and began crawling under the table looking for his wallet. There, under a wrapper of soy chips, lay his wallet, damp with beer. He stuffed it into his back pocket and stood up. The other Marines were laughing at him. Some barked like small dogs.
Little friend, if you need a condom, I've got plenty, said Bo.
Xiao turned away from Bo's crude hand gestures and pushed through the crowd to the back of the bar, stumbling over toes and slipping on a slime of spilled liquor and beer. He made it without falling and stood in the darkened entrance to the bathroom. Was this the right place to wait? It was quieter. He cast a look over his shoulder to make sure none of his squad were going to humiliate him again. All clear. When he turned around, there she was, standing close enough for him to kiss, if he had had the courage. Did you forget my drink? She said. Xiao flushed and looked down at his feet, again catching another eyeful of her breasts. She put a hand on his belt buckle and tugged slightly. He leaned back, and she tugged just a little bit harder. That's okay, we don't need it. Come with me, she said, and led him away from the bathrooms, where it's quieter. Yes, better, he muttered, but not loud enough for the translator to pick up. He followed her down the humid stairway that led from the bar's main room to a pitch-black storage area. As they reached the bottom of the stairs, he realized that she was taller than him. But as she drew his face into her breasts, he decided he was just the right size. Lavender and talc. It felt like all the blood that had rushed to his cheeks was now flowing to his groin. He felt a new courage rising up inside him. Bo was right. I should have gotten a condom when I had the chance. She sighed and held him closer, drawing the moment out. His body stiffened, and then spasmed, as the sharpened stem of the white sunglasses drove in just behind his jawbone, severing his internal carotid artery. University of Wisconsin, Madison. When she saw the two men in matching gray suits enter the back of the lecture hall, Vernalise Lee realized she should have listened to her mother's warnings. But instead, she told her mom that she needed to stop reading Wikipedia, that what had happened to the Japanese Americans in the 1940s wouldn't happen in the 21st century. People were better than that now. Or so she'd thought. She continued lecturing, unconsciously adopting a more Southern California accent with each word. From here, you can see that a rack mount power system has its limitations. What are they? Space, for sure, she said. So what if she'd been born in Beijing? She had grown up in Santa Monica. But the advantage, density, by having a fluid-based energy storage system that, with a comfortable design, we can address industrial pulse power applications where the current rack designs fall short. She had played beach volleyball in high school, varsity. The switch today operates for 4 milliseconds, and we are working to increase power density. That goes back to the question of how to store the energy. It always comes back to density, and fluid is the answer.
She watched the two men take seats. The suits were evidently cheap, likely Dockers, but it didn't matter. If they wanted to blend in, wearing suits and ties on campus any day but graduation wasn't the way to go. Then she noticed they weren't wearing viz glasses, so they weren't even recording the lecture. Were they just checking in to make sure students were actually in class? It wouldn't be surprising, the whole campus knew conscription was coming. The other element is addressing contamination in the switches, which always, always, always leads to shorter minority carrier lifespan. Plus, we're maximizing peak power again, which makes contamination a major cause of degradation in these light-activated switch designs. So what was their deal? No one attended a lecture on the mathematical dynamics of pulse-powered systems for fun. Okay, she said, wrapping up. You know where to find me on the course, Sim, later, if you have any questions.
I'd like to ask one, with your students' permission, of course, said Professor Leonowski, who stopped by earlier and was sitting in the front row.
He perched his viz glasses atop his bald head and smiled with the ease of someone for whom the pressure of the tenure clock was a distant memory.
Everyone, we're not done yet. Have we all got a few more minutes?
Of course we do, said Leonowski, as ever answering his own question.
Certainly, said Vern, hiding her trembling hands behind her back. Why did believing you were about to be accused of an unnamed crime make you feel guilty, even when you knew you were innocent? She could barely speak Mandarin, at least not without a horrible American accent, as her mother never failed to remind her.
Let's get to the practicalities.
What can anyone really do with a fluid-based battery the size of a house with only short-term storage capabilities? Leonowski asked. There's no market for that as far as I can see, can you? He was on the tenure committee and would often drop in on junior professors' lectures and ask pointed questions, just so no one would forget his role as a gatekeeper to their future careers.
We don't know, yet, Vern said, fighting the stammer welling up inside her. What I'm saying is, no one can anticipate what future needs might be. Maybe it's bigger sims, or...
The men in the back of the room stared intently at her. They did not even blink.
I'm just not sure. But that we don't know the applications now doesn't mean we won't find a use later. Back when computers were first developed, the CEO of IBM thought the world market would be only 5 computers in total. We know how that worked out, said Vern.
Indeed, but obviously not every invention is comparable to the computer, said Professor Leonowski.
Tenure be damned. Vern just wanted out of the room, away from those men. She looked down at her sandals and back up at her future.
My answer is that I will have to get you a better answer, said Vern.
I think that would be for the best, said Leonowski.
The students were bolting out of the room. Vern was embarrassed by her performance, but relieved to see that at least the two men were gone now. Professor Leonowski was occupied with a pair of first-year graduate students. If she moved quickly, she could get out without having to talk to anyone. Right now, she needed something to eat and a half-hour dive somewhere tropical to chill out. Maybe the Turks and Caicos sim. She was bent over her bag, struggling with the buckle, when the letters FBI appeared a few inches in front of her face. She looked up. One of the suits stood before her. He held a worn black leather wallet that revealed a badge and ID. The other man was back at the door, blocking the room's only exit.
Miss Verna Laisley, we need you to come with us.
That's Dr. Lee, she thought to herself, but she didn't bother to correct him.
No handcuffs? She asked bitterly. You're not even going to frisk me? You at least get a good write-up in the campus paper? Chinese spy busted in our midst.
The agent shook his head and put his hand on her shoulder. He spoke in a whisper, with the awkward gentleness of somebody not used to caring what other people thought of what he said.
Miss Lee, it's not like that, not at all. We're here for your protection. Everything you said today matters more than you can imagine.
Fort Mason, San Francisco. Captain Jamie Simmons wiped the sweat from his forehead. Having to take a bus and then walk uphill from the stop was not the way he imagined a Navy officer would return home after 9 months at sea.
but at least he was home. Home now meant an officer's quarters in Fort Mason in San Francisco's Marina District. Overlooking the bay, it was priceless real estate even in wartime. The Navy might have been pushed around at sea, but it was clearly having its way on land. Marines guarded checkpoints and blocked civilian traffic from entering Bay Street. A pair of tan air defense Humvees, bristling with missiles, were parked at the corner of Laguna and Bay. Each pointed four AIM-120 SLAM rams, surface-launched advanced medium-range air-to-air missiles, accusingly to the west. Across the water, high up on Hawk Hill in Marin, were more missile batteries and a radar installation under construction. The Directorate had made no moves to push beyond the edge of its so-called Eastern Pacific Stability Zone, so the only action the National Guardsmen manning the mobile batteries had seen so far were afternoon games of soccer with the neighborhood kids. On the sidewalk in front of Jamie's house, a small crowd had gathered. For the most part, they were people he did not know. Squaring his shoulders, he forced a smile and walked up to them. They took in his captain's insignia, and then paused at the scar just above his right eye. They shook his hand, some even hugged him. He was the hero who'd commanded the only ship that had fought its way out of Pearl. Everyone needs some hope, and people seemed to get it just from touching Jamie. They chose to ignore that everything since that day had gone from bad to worse, both for Jamie and America. The front door opened and his kids rushed out, crashed into his legs, and hung on with their lovingly desperate grip.
"Claire, Martin, I missed you so much," said Jamie. "You're all grown up."
He lifted a child in each arm, swaying slightly as if he were back at sea. The crowd on the sidewalk backed off, giving him space. They knew how it was. Martin leaned into Jamie's ear.
"Daddy, I made you a sign inside. Did you bring me anything?"
Jamie smiled sadly.
"Sorry, not tonight," he said. "Show me the sign."
"I made it first,"
said Claire, trying to win back his attention. Jamie set the kids down as Lindsay approached. Her dark brown hair was shorter than he remembered. She stood on her tiptoes, and he kissed her, savoring the feel of her hair as it brushed across his cheek. That moment was something no Sim could capture. She also looked thinner than he remembered, likely from the worry he'd put her through. She was even thinner than when he'd first seen her, running the Burke Gilman Trail near the University of Washington on a rainy spring morning. A smile was all it took for him to notice her. Though he had already been exhausted from crew practice, he'd kept running just for a chance to ask her name when she finally stopped, 4 miles later at a water fountain.
"Over here," said Claire, pulling on his hand. "Come see the sign we made."
Martin studied his father's uniform intently.
"I like your ribbons. Do you want some cereal?" he said.
"Later we can have some," said Jamie. "Right now, I want to see this sign."
Martin and Claire led their father into the sparsely furnished living room. No rug, only a couch and a single chair.
"Not much here," said Lindsay. "The rest is still in San Diego."
"Lots of room for parties, at least,"
said Jamie, looking around the room as the guests began to file in. Navy dress uniforms, spouses in suits or cocktail dresses, and a lot of kids. Before the war, you wouldn't have seen so many kids at a party like this, Jamie thought. Now everyone wanted to keep them close.
"They've all been waiting for this moment. I've been waiting. All part of Navy life, right, Captain?"
said Lindsay, stretching out his new rank. Jamie took in her smile and brought her close. Wives were usually there for promotion ceremonies, but it had all been done on the fly as they prepped for the shitstorm that the Guam relief mission had turned into.
"Daddy, over here," shouted Martin. "No kissing."
Jamie navigated through a series of hugs and handshakes to get to where a 3-foot by 5-foot Welcome Home Daddy sign hung. Purple and green crayon, the kids' respective favorite colors, covered the entire sign, which meant no one else had been allowed to contribute.
"Wow, this is amazing," said Jamie.
He knelt down and hugged both kids hard, fighting back tears. Then he detected a faint, acrid smell. It was the pungent musk of a life pledged to steel ships, to wooden piers coated in tarry creosote, and to a losing battle against rust and rot. Still kneeling, Jamie slowly looked over and saw the black leather work boots. The boots were old, worn, nicked, and creased, but they still shone. The bulbs of the steel toes giving off an eight ball's luster. The boots were turned out slightly, maybe 10 degrees at the left, 15 degrees at the right. It was a ready stance, as if the world might pitch or heave at any moment. Jamie's body recognized it all first and sent an icy blast of adrenaline into his veins before his brain could process the presence of his father.
"Chief," said Jamie as he slowly stood. "What are you doing here?"
Lindsay jumped in before an answer could come.
"Your father's been here every weekend since we arrived, doing everything from machining a new pedal for Martin's bike to playing games with the kids so I could take a shower," said Lindsay. "He's been really helpful."
Mike just held out his right hand. It was meant to be a welcoming gesture, yet the sheer size of the hand hinted at malice or injury. The back of the hand was scrubbed red, but creosote, rust, and grease still seemed to ooze from the pores. The missing tip of the pinky was more evidence that these hands were tools first.
"Hello, James," said Mike.
He stared at Jamie, daring his son to say what he really thought.
"He's made a real difference here," said Lindsay, still trying to smooth over the moment.
"I wish I could take credit for the sign, but I have been able to help with the house. With all the directorate cyber attacks, the fridge won't talk to the phone, and the toilet doesn't know whether to flush or clean itself without instructions from its Beijing masters. I can't fix the digital stuff, but I can at least clean up and rig some workarounds," said Mike.
Jamie released his two kids and shook the hand, suddenly without the confident grip he had expected to use.
"Okay, kids, go show your friends the sandbox Grandpa built," said Lindsay.
For the next hour, Lindsay stayed close to Jamie. She had always been good at this sort of thing, the chit-chat, the empty how-are-yous, and all he could think about was his father walking the perimeter of his yard, keeping an eye on his kids, nursing a can of Coke. Soon the party began to break up, the guests having put in their appearances, but knowing they weren't supposed to linger. When Lindsay went inside to clean up, there was no longer a way for Jamie to avoid talking to his father. The two men took their drinks and stood on the back patio, their silhouettes indistinguishable from each other. They looked down at the Fort Mason Green, toward the piers that had once hosted jazz concerts and wine tastings. A pair of pockmarked literal combat ships and four Mark VI patrol boats nuzzled the piers. Their tiny silhouettes made the absence of the larger warships that should have been there all the more obvious.
"Hell of a nice house, Captain," said Mike. "Can't say I ever had any admirals for neighbors. Must go with the promotion."
"What's going on here?" said Jamie, ignoring his father's attempt at small talk.
"I figured Lindsay could use the help," said Mike.
"You did? You don't even know her or the kids. You didn't even come to our wedding," said Jamie.
"War changes things for all of us," said Mike.
"I'll say." Jamie looked at the walnut-sized knuckles he knew were as hard as stones. "I don't think I ever saw you drink a soda in my entire life." Each man took a sip of his drink and waited for the other to speak. The silence was occasionally broken by the laughing and howling of kids.
"The Navy Cross is a hell of a thing, James," said Mike, changing tack.
"It's because I got the Coronado out," said Jamie. "Riley died right in front of me at Pearl."
"Still don't know how you did it with an LCS," said Mike. He growled out each letter with disdain. "Better ships didn't."
"Easy, Chief. Coronado's still my ship," said Jamie. "At least what's left of it."
"Well, she made you captain. You're always going to owe her that," said Mike. "Any idea what they're going to do with her?"
"Maybe make a museum or memorial out of it when the war's over," said Jamie. "Or maybe turn it into dog tags. All that metal we need has to come from somewhere. We could patch up the hits we took at Pearl, but the missile hit we took in the Guam relief op wrecked the whole engine room for good."
"You don't belong here with her. You belong at sea."
"Of all the people to say that," muttered Jamie.
"So now we're starting again?" said Mike. "Okay, I deserve that. I wasn't as good at the home stuff as I was at the job.
You could have been, said Jamie, if you just tried half as hard at your more important job of taking care of your kids. Both of them. God damn it. Don't you lay that blame on me, said Mike. Even if I'd been home, I couldn't have saved her. It's Mackenzie. Say her name, growled Jamie.
The two stared at each other in silence, as Martin and Claire played tag in the yard beyond them.
So, how was it really for the fleet? Said Mike, trying again to steer the discussion to easier ground. There's a word for doing the same thing over and over and thinking it will have different results, said Jamie. I'm sure you heard. They sunk the Ford and the Vinson. The exact minute we crossed their Eastern Pacific Stability Zone line. Just like they had warned. Both the carriers and even the subs. We still pushed on after that and things got worse.
What the hell is going on? Too much power in those ships for them to be just torn apart like that.
Air Force's toy planes are all hacked and can't get off the ground while the Directorate owns the heavens. Satellites, space stations, everything. They can see every move we make and target at will. We knew they'd eventually be able to do that to the surface ships, but now even the subs can't hide. And if they can't hide,
they go from sharks to chum, said Mike.
Only the boomers were left untargeted, said Jamie, referring to the ballistic missile submarines that made up the strategic nuclear force.
They wouldn't hit them. Not unless they wanted us to cut their population by half, said Mike. We should have done that when the Chinese first showed up at Pearl. After what those airstrikes did to the 25th ID base in Hawaii, and all those Marines on Oahu, fucking butchers, they were asking for us to nuke them. We still should. I really hope it doesn't come to that, said Jamie.
It will, mark my words, said Mike.
I'm telling you, we should have nuked them the minute things started to go south. At least the chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff had the honor to resign when the so-called commander-in-chief pussied out.
That's just the spin he put on it after he got fired, said Jamie. By the time the National Command Authority figured out what was happening, it had already happened. After that, strategic calculus changed. Going nuclear would just be revenge to the point of suicide. Hell, given how deep the Chinese penetrated our comms net, no one could even have known if the nuke orders would go through. We might just have been giving them a pretext to strike us first.
We should still just do it, and do it now. Just nuke Beijing, Shanghai.
And make sure you get Hainan, too, said Mike. No diplomacy. No more of that reimagining our world bullshit from those eunuchs on TV. We should make their cities glow.
What about Moscow? Said Jamie. Should we nuke that too? How about Paris, Rome, and Berlin? For not stepping up to join the fight an ocean away from them that was already over. And Tokyo, for kindly helping us clean up our bases and then asking us to leave?
If we went with your plan, the whole world would be glowing, including here. He nodded over to where the kids were still chasing each other. Mike tipped his Coke can to the unlit Golden Gate Bridge and the black void separating San Francisco and Marin.
The greedy bastards could have just bought the Golden Gate, said Mike.
I thought they already did 4 years back, said Jamie.
No, that was the Carquinez Bridge. Some toll road crap, said Mike.
Well, this isn't over. Hawaii's not giving up either. Resistance is heating up there. A lot of the troops who made it out fought in Iraq and Afghanistan. They saw insurgency up close, and I hear they're trying it themselves now, said Jamie.
Payback is a bitch, said Mike.
Both men paused to listen to the chorus of kids' laughter as they ran by in the dark.
Lindsay's been really good through all this, said Mike. Some people, they literally forgot how to drive, so they've been paralyzed since the Chinese knocked out our GPS. No more auto drives, and they're just stuck without anyone at the wheel. Like America. Not your wife, though. I wish there were more like her in this country, said Mike.
Jamie paused mid-sip and gazed silently at his dad. How was it possible that he was here? How was it possible that he knew better than Jamie how his own wife was doing?
Just look at this party, Mike continued. You'd never think her husband's ship
had been shot to pieces and assumed lost just a little while ago. You will not find a stronger or better woman. You know how I know that? Hal, said Jamie. She led me in the front door, said Mike.
That's because she doesn't know you, said Jamie.
James, I made the effort. It's been 14 years since you saw me. I'm different now. Because of your mom, because of your sister's death, because of a lot of things, said Mike.
And here you are. Like I should just forget it all, Jamie said.
The two men stared at each other in silence. All right, then, have it your way. I tried. I should get going anyway, said Mike. I've got an early day tomorrow.
Aren't they all now? Said Jamie. Mentor crew job, eh?
The initial wave of losses had whittled down not just the frontline fleet, but also its human capital. The mentor program was started as a way to tap into the expertise that still remained among those too old to be drafted back into service. The old, retired, non-commissioned officers had been spread out among the fleet, the idea being that they would help guide the transition for all the new crews that had to be trained up.
I damn well wasn't going to fight this war as a contractor, said Mike.
So where do they have you working?
I can't get into it right now, said Mike, not even with you.
Some things don't change, said Jamie, with a bitter edge in his voice.
You'll see. They really do, said Mike, turning and walking to say goodbye to the kids. Directorate Command, Honolulu, Hawaii Special Administrative Zone. I live in lonely desolation, and wonder when my end will come. Pushkin should have joined military intelligence, thought Colonel Vladimir Andreevich Markov. The Russian Spetsnaz officer poured himself another glass of hot tea and continued to read, the world of poetry his one escape from the stack of memos from General Yu Shi Li's office. The collection of Pushkin poetry was well-traveled, having accompanied him to Chechnya, Georgia, Ukraine, Tajikistan, Sudan, and Venezuela. And now, another war zone's humidity and grime